about my favorite topic, which is resilience. And as Andrea mentioned, much of this work has been done with Dr. Dennis Charney, who is the dean at the Mount Sinai Medical School, and a host of others, close collaborators and friends like John Crystal and Andy Morgan, Rachel Yehuda, and Rob Peterzak, and others. And for years, our research group studied post-traumatic stress disorder, trying our best to understand risk factors and protective factors, and also the neuroscience or neurobiology of the fear and stress response. And about 15 years ago, we decided to take a look at resilience as well. And resilience is a complex topic, but one that we thought was really important to investigate. I'm going to turn to the slides, and the first number of slides are just photographs, so I'll just go through them quickly. And they're basically just to show, which all of you know, is that all of us are exposed to all sorts of stresses during our lifetime. It might be bullying, perhaps work stress, relationship stress, the photo of the wedding cake and the man and woman shooting one another. Believe it or not, there are bakers out there who bake divorce cakes these days. There's global warming. And then there are traumas that most of us will be exposed to, at least one major trauma sometime in our life, such as a natural disaster. And if you see the photograph of the tsunami, it's very frightening. You can see the individuals running from this huge wave of water. Then there, of course, is the stress of war, terrorism, and you can see the photograph of the Statue of Liberty, 9/11, and then the sudden death of loved ones. And the last slide, photograph, is caregiver stress. Now, what are the consequences of stress? Well, there have been thousands of studies looking at what elements of stress are most toxic. And it turns out that it is uncontrollable stress which is most detrimental. In other words, stress that I really cannot manage. So an example of this might be a child abuse. I'm little, my abuser is big, I really cannot control that stress. Another example would be a soldier who's in war, and perhaps imagine sitting in a foxhole, a mortar round is flying overhead, and you have no control as to where that is going to land. Now, that is uncontrollable stress, and there are many, many animal and human studies showing that that's the kind of stress that can be detrimental. So this uncontrollable stress can cause burnout, it can cause post-traumatic stress disorder, it can cause depression and anxiety, and it can contribute to a host of physical disorders, including cardiac disorders. So let's just turn to the definition of resilience, and this is complicated. There is no one accepted definition of resilience, but most of us think of resilience as the ability to bend but not break, to bounce back, and sometimes even to grow when faced with adversity. And the American Psychological Association defines resilience as the process of adapting well in the face of adversity, trauma, tragedy, threats, or even significant sources of stress. Now, on the next slide, which is titled Multidimensional Nature of Resilience, we see that resilience is a complex construct. And it is quite possible for someone, for me, for you, to be competent and very adept at dealing with stress in one domain, but not necessarily in another. So, for example, I might be resilient with regard to my academic or work life, but not so much with regard to my social life. And it's also true that the individual, we, interact with the environment in very complex ways. So when we first started looking into resilience, we were pretty much totally or solely looking at factors within the individual that enhanced their ability to be resilient. But this quote, I think, is an important one. The individual's response to stress and trauma takes place in the context of other human beings, available resources, specific cultures and religions, organizations, communities, and societies, each of which may be more or less resilient in their own right and more or less capable of supporting the individual. So the point is, we never go at this alone. Sometimes we feel like we're doing negotiating life alone, but in fact, there are many different layers of society and so forth that are influencing our behavior and our ability to deal with stress. Well, what about the question, how important is resilience? And this is a quote from the Harvard Business Review. More than education, more than experience, more than training, a person's resilience will determine who succeeds and who fails. That's true in the cancer ward, it's true in the Olympics, it's true in the boardroom. And actually, I think most of you have probably noticed this, that there has been a gradual paradigm shift, if you will, or the beginning of one, where the primary focus in medicine and psychology has been on understanding, diagnosing, and treating illness. And I think that's very important. And in general, the professions are pretty good at this. But what we haven't mastered as well yet, although there is a shift in this direction, is toward promoting health and wellness. For example, learning how to help people build their strengths, and again, to bounce back, sometimes even to flourish with challenges, and to live a life that has meaning and purpose for that individual. As I said, resilience is a complex construct, and in this next slide called Factors That Influence Resilience, there are clearly genetic factors, there are developmental factors, neurobiologic factors, and psychosocial factors. I won't have much time to go into any one of these, but I'll just touch briefly on them. So clearly, genetics has an impact on pretty much everything we do, who we are, but not as much as many of us may think. This slide is a slide with the graph of different variants of the serotonin transporter gene. And serotonin is, as you know, important in depression. What this slide shows is that if you inherit a particular variation of the serotonin transporter gene, the SS variation, then in the face of severe maltreatment, if you are exposed to severe maltreatment, you are significantly more likely to become depressed than someone who inherited the LL variant. So we might think of the SS variant as being a vulnerability factor in response to stress. We might think of the LL as a protective or resilience factor in response to stress. It's actually considerably more complicated than this, but this is the basic idea. This would be called a gene-environment interaction. Having the SS allele makes you no more likely to get depressed than having the LL allele if you are not maltreated. So that's where the gene-environment interaction comes in. And even another fascinating aspect to this is Joan Kaufman, who's a colleague, did a study with foster children and showed this same finding, that children with the SS variation were more likely to become depressed when maltreated, but she also found that high levels of social support tended to mask the vulnerability in those who had the SS variation. In other words, you could have the SS variation the genetic vulnerability, but with high levels of social support, it didn't seem to matter much at all in terms of whether or not you were going to become depressed when you were maltreated. So genetic factors. Now, what about developmental factors? How you were raised and the environment you were exposed to? Well, I said earlier that unmanageable stress, like child abuse, can lead to something called learned helplessness, the idea that I really can't succeed. And it can also lead to exaggerated emotional and behavioral and nervous system responses to future stresses. So if a infant youngster, is placed in these uncontrollable situations over and over, in general, they have a tendency to react more robustly to stresses in the future. I mean, these are averages, of course. And then there's something called stress inoculation. And this means that when someone is exposed to a stressor, but a stressor that they could manage, that tends to make them somewhat more resilient. And if you gradually increase the level of the stressor, but always keep it within the manageable range, and this is true with any activity, anybody who's done, suppose you want to run a marathon, you don't want to go out and run 26 miles the first day, you'll injure yourself, but you'll start with a mile and then a couple days later or whatever, you'll run 2 miles, et cetera, and you'll slowly become stress inoculated. You'll slowly become adapted to higher and higher levels of stress. And when this happens in childhood, let's put it this way. So if parents sometimes ask, is it good to stress my child? Yes, it is good, but only if that stress is manageable. When that stress becomes overwhelming and unmanageable, it tends not to be good. However, having manageable stresses tends to help a child during development. In other words, you don't want to be a neglectful parent because that's too stressful for the child, but you also don't want to be overly protective in the sense that the child never really has an opportunity to experiment and learn to deal with stresses on their own. Sometimes people talk about helicopter parenting. And you know what? It's really hard not to do that. I have a daughter, and it's so hard not to do that. But everybody needs challenges. Everybody needs to master those challenges. And it turns out that infants and children who have had experiences that are not overwhelming, but that were a challenge and that they had to master, tend to master stresses in the future as adults more adaptively than children and young and the infants that weren't stressed at all. They weren't neglected, but they weren't stressed at all. Some stress can be good. That's the point. Stress that's manageable. Now, there are lots of neurobiologic factors that are associated with resilience. I'll give you an example of you. So one example is how my sympathetic nervous system responds to stress. So the sympathetic nervous system is my fight-flight system. Adrenaline, noradrenaline, and when I'm in a dangerous situation, I get a big release of these transmitters, chemicals, and they help to save my life. They pump extra blood gets pumped to my muscles and so forth. And so my sympathetic adrenaline, noradrenaline response to stress is adaptive, but it's also very important to be able to turn it off, to turn it down, to come back to baseline. So there are all sorts of mechanisms through which the body does that, and one is a substance called neuropeptide Y. I mention that because we did a number of studies looking at neuropeptide Y, and some of the studies were with special forces soldiers during very, very high stress survival training. And we found that the soldiers who released more neuropeptide Y tended to perform better What that did is they had big adrenaline responses like all the other soldiers, which was good. But they were also able to bring that stress response and the adrenaline back to baseline when the stressor was over. Another factor in the neurobiology of resilience is the ability of our prefrontal cortex to inhibit the amygdala. The amygdala is an area in the brain that is devoted to translating emotions, responding in an emotional way, assessing and responding to danger, for example, and it's one of the areas that helps to keep us alive. But you have to keep it in check, because otherwise you'd be probably responding to every possible even hint of a danger or over-responding to such a stimulus. And the prefrontal cortex, the front of my brain, which is very important for thinking and for controlling my impulses and for making decisions and for planning in the future and so forth, one of the things that my prefrontal cortex does is to inhibit the amygdala. So it keeps this fear-detecting center in check in an appropriate way. And there is some evidence to suggest that having a prefrontal cortical functioning that inhibits the amygdala well, moderates it, can help with adaptive functioning to stress. There's a slide that's a picture of a brain, and actually it's a slide, you can't see this, but there's a number of elements of the slide. But the element that you're seeing right here, the prefrontal cortex is on the left, and the amygdala is right at the bottom there, near the beginning of the arrow.
And this is slide 25 for handout 1.
Okay. And basically what it's saying is that the amygdala, the fear center, is stimulating activation of the brain and even of the prefrontal cortex, getting you very, very alert, but it may be too much. It may overwhelm parts of the brain. The arrow you don't see that's underneath is the arrow going from the prefrontal cortex to the amygdala, keeping the amygdala in check. So this is checks and balances. And it's really the balance between the inhibitory function of the prefrontal cortex and the activating function of the amygdala. And that balance is important in how we negotiate stress. In fact, many of the therapies that we think about, or many of the trainings, are in part strengthening the prefrontal cortex, or at least this is one way to think about it. And that might include psychoeducation. So I understand what's going on around me. Or cognitive behavioral therapy, which helps me to question some of the exaggerated beliefs I might have. For example, this isn't exactly fear, but I'll mention this in optimism and pessimism. If I flunk a test in algebra, I might say to myself, oh my gosh, I flunked this test. I'm really stupid. I'm stupid in math. I'm stupid in everything. I'll never succeed in math, in my other subjects. I'll never get into college, and so forth. So I have what cognitive behaviorists say, I have catastrophized and I have generalized. I have turned this into something horrible in every aspect of my life. Now, cognitive behavioral therapy and cognitive reappraisal teaches us, to stop and say, wait a minute, is that really true? Is there real evidence? The fact that I flunked this test, am I really going to flunk out of high school and never get into college? And so forth. That's taking essentially the prefrontal cortex and quieting down some of the fear-related areas. And it turns out that there are various forms of meditation that appear to be doing this as well, like mindfulness meditation that we'll talk about in a little bit. I'm going to spend most of the time on some of the psychosocial factors that have been found to be associated with resilience. And Dennis Charney and I were very fortunate to interview, have been very fortunate to interview a large number of highly resilient individuals. Some were former prisoners of war from Vietnam. John McCain sorts, very sturdy. Some were special forces instructors, and we thought that they would be good people to ask about how to teach people to be more resilient, both emotionally and physically. And then we interviewed many civilian men and women and children who had been through very challenging circumstances and who had done well, nevertheless. It doesn't mean that they didn't have symptoms. Same with the prisoners of war and special forces instructors. Not that they didn't have some symptoms of depression or PTSD, but they were able to function and move on. So when we did these interviews, we looked for recurrent themes, and we kept hearing the same themes over and over again and some of the same coping mechanisms. And then we went to the social scientific literature in the journals and also to the neuroscience literature, and we found a lot of support for the factors that we kept hearing about in our interviews. And we boiled down 10, what we call 10 resilience factors. I don't know if it's 10, it could be 12, 15. I don't think anyone really knows, but these were the ones that we kept hearing over and over again in a large number of resilient individuals. And they were learning to face your fears, and I'll talk about most of these a little bit, cultivating positive emotions, actively coping with stress, solidifying your moral compass, practicing religion and spirituality, if that makes sense for you, not for everybody. This is very important, seeking and attracting social support. Cognitive flexibility, learning to look for opportunity in the midst of adversity, trying to learn how to look at situations from more than one angle. Training, training, training. No substitute for training. Body, mind. And finding and imitating resilient role models. And we'll talk a little bit about this. This can be very powerful. And finally, extracting purpose and meaning from work and life. So let's start with regulating emotions. There's a slide of a little cat and some very big dogs surrounding the cat. And this would be what we would call a resilient cat.
And just to alert the audience, we're now on handout 2.
And it's very important, honestly, for all of us. I know I work on this all the time, to try to learn to face our fears. And when we ask some special forces instructors, how do you teach your students, your trainees, to deal with fear? And he said, you know what? All of the trainees are afraid. I'm afraid. But we try to think of, to reframe fear. We try to think of fear as a friend, in a way, because it's really a warning that something's not right and that I need to really pay attention to what's going on and see if I can detect what's wrong and come up with a solution. The problem, in his opinion, and I do agree, is not so much fear, but it's panic. If you allow fear to hang around for too long, it can move over into panic. Once it's at a panic stage, it's very difficult to make rational decisions. And, you know, we become just overwhelmed. And the next slide is a graph, and it's what people call an inverted U. And really what it's saying is that a little bit of anxiety or moderate anxiety, moderate stress, actually is good for performance. We perform better. If we're a little nervous before we give a talk, if we're moderately nervous before we play in a sports contest, we often perform better. However, if we get extremely nervous, our performance tends to get worse. And that's what this graph is showing. Now, when you ask the special forces or others, what are some good ways to face fear? This next slide is extremely practical and sounds kind of obvious, but actually, I believe it's accurate. Not necessarily easy to do. And that is to acquire information about what you're afraid of. In other words, learn as much as you can about what you're afraid of. Don't avoid it. Learn the skills necessary to get through the fear. Have a plan and a backup plan. Practice the plan and backup plan. And believe me, people like the special forces practice, practice, practice. And then, whenever possible, try to deal with the feared situation with someone who you trust and you care about. Now, this next slide is on the right. You'll see a special forces instructor who's been trained very well. This exercise is very scary. Your hands and feet are tied, and you sink to the bottom of the swimming pool. You wait there until you almost can't stand it anymore, and someone comes and rescues you. The gentleman on the right is a special forces instructor. I mean, not instructor, he's a trainee, but he's really learned how to control his fear. The gentleman on the left is having a panic attack. See all those bubbles? This gentleman has not learned to control his fear in this situation. Well, it turns out that this gentleman was my research colleague, Andy Morgan, who, for some reason, decided that it might be fun to try this without any training. And you can see that it wasn't fun at all. Now, I was smart and decided that this did not look like anything I wanted to try because I'm sure I would have had a panic attack as well. The next slide is a quote from Thich Nhat Hanh, who is a spiritual thinker and writer, and wonderful, I think. He's talking about fear and so forth. If you try to run away instead of confronting and embrace your ill-being and fear, you will not look deeply into its nature and will never see a way out. That is why you should hold your suffering tenderly and closely, looking deeply into it to discover its true nature and find a way out. So Thich Nhat Hanh might say, if he was afraid, he might say, "Hello, fear." Of course, this takes a lot of practice. "Hello, fear. I know you. I welcome you. I am going to take care of you like a mother takes care of her baby." This is the exact opposite of avoidance. It's there. I'm going to look at it. I'm going to deal with it as best I can. And the next slide shows that actually all of the anxiety disorders, like panic disorder and generalized anxiety disorder and post-traumatic stress disorder, avoidance and failure to face fear is really at the heart of those, quote, disorders. And in fact, if you look at the therapies that are used to treat anxiety conditions, the most successful ones tend to be exposure therapies, where you actually have to face your fear with the therapist, like prolonged exposure, and even mindfulness, which is what Thich Nhat Hanh was talking about, in meditation. You are allowing that thought to be present, trying your best not to judge it, but not avoiding it. Another factor that's very important is positive emotions. And what are positive emotions or optimism? Well, the basic belief that the future will be bright, the basic belief that there'll be fear, light at the end of the tunnel. This is really hard. I mean, I can't do this all the time. Most people can't. But what we've found, and not just we, just many researchers have found, that positive emotions are strongly associated with fewer psychiatric symptoms, better physical health, and reduced heart rate and cardiovascular responses to stress. So under stress, less of a rise of blood pressure and less of an increase in heart rate. But the optimism that we see and others see in resilience is not rose-colored optimism. So it's not this kind of Pollyanna-ish, everything's going to be okay, without carefully assessing the situation. The realistic optimist, like the pessimist, pays close attention to relevant negative information. So they see as much of the negative as the optimist does, but they don't dwell on that information, and the irrelevant negative information that some pessimists will dwell on, the optimist seems to know how to ignore it And they also seem to be good at disengaging from problems that they can't solve. And this is part of, we'll talk about acceptance in a bit. Now, how is it possible to become more optimistic? Actually, it is. It's not easy. Norman Vincent Peale was right when he said the power of positive thinking. So inserting positive thoughts, thinking positive thoughts, it does help. It's not a cure-all. In fact, the cognitive behavior therapists and researchers, as I said earlier, have found that learning to refute the negative, learning to challenge your beliefs, are they really accurate? Is it really that bad? So forth, can be a very powerful way to enhance positive emotions. And, of course, there is one of the things I mentioned, you know, flunking a algebra test, for example, the pessimist catastrophizes and generalizes, whereas the optimist tends to say, oh, I flunked this test, this isn't good, but, you know, my other subjects are okay, I'll be okay, or maybe I didn't study enough, maybe this isn't my thing. So they tend not to catastrophize and generalize. And if you think about it, these are habits in the way people think about or explain events in their life. And the more you notice what you're doing, there are opportunities to change that. There's a therapy, for example, called learned optimism. Again, it's not easy, but you can learn to become more optimistic. Social support, I forget, we don't have time to talk about the little frog there, but social support is really, really important. Far more important than we ever imagined before we started this research. Because isolation and poor social support is very bad for your health. In fact, people who are very isolated, that isolation tends to be as detrimental to how long they live as is obesity, cigarette smoking, hypertension, or level of physical activity. On the other hand, high social support, in other words, having friends that really would come to your aid, making friends. And by the way, in social networks, it's just as much you reaching out and helping others as it is others helping you. That can be very protective of mental health conditions. And actually, if you have close friends near you or with you during stressful situations, your nervous system does not respond as robustly. You have a calmer response. And part of that may be, in the next slide, due to oxytocin, which is a chemical that's related to bonding and related to social attachments. But oxytocin, when I'm feeling attached, also decreases, remember the amygdala, the fear center? It decreases the response of the fear center. So when I'm with people who I really trust and care about and even touching them, that tends to decrease my response to fear. The next factor is moral compass, which we were surprised was so important. And there's a photograph of Admiral Stockdale, who was the senior commanding officer at the Hanoi Hilton, which was a terrible prison in North Vietnam where Americans were tortured and so forth. And here's a quote that he has about integrity. You can't buy it or sell it. When supported with education, a person's integrity can give him something to rely on when his perspective seems to blur, when rules and principles seem to waver, and when he's faced with hard choices of right and wrong. It's something to keep him afloat when he's drowning. And the next slide is about courage and how important courage is. Moral courage. Standing up for what is right, and it's not easy. It's very hard, but it's strongly associated with resilience. And we all know in the next slide, Martin Luther King is a beautiful example of moral courage. Here is a gentleman who stood up for what he believed in, even if it meant his death. This is resilience. Resilience is also strongly associated with altruism. We were a little, again, surprised at this. But it turns out that even in the animal world, there's a term called reciprocal altruism. Animals that share more of their resources during times of plenty tend to receive back more resources from others that they've given to during times of deprivation when there aren't many resources or food around. So there may even be an evolutionary advantage to altruism. But in any case, it's clear that people who are able to help others, to give to others, tend to be more resilient under times of stress. And that may be a good way to become more resilient, in fact, if you can, the degree to which you can. There are certain times, many times in our lives, when we can't. There's not much we can do because we're struggling ourselves. Religion and spirituality, again, many, in fact, most of the people we interviewed called upon their religious and spiritual beliefs during much of their life, but particularly during times of high stress. And there is a huge scientific literature on the relationship between religions and spirituality and health, even how long you live. Now, this is complicated because there are probably many factors involved in the association between religion, spirituality, and health. And part of it seems to be social support. So going to religious services or spiritual services can be very helpful because you're with people who tend to be like-minded. In most spiritual practices, people value kindness, they value caring for one another, and so forth. But in any case, spiritual and religious practices have been associated with resilience. We've talked a little bit about cognitive flexibility, and that's being able to take multiple viewpoints with regard to a particular situation. So we talked about possibly seeing opportunity in the midst of adversity, looking for a silver lining. That this can be very difficult, and it may not be appropriate all the time, but when possible. Now, part of cognitive flexibility is also acceptance. Now, we all know the Serenity Prayer. Alcoholics Anonymous uses this. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And the second quote is, I think, really a rather profound quote from Eckhart Tolle, who is also a spiritual thinker. Accept, then act. Whatever the present moment contains, accept it as if you had chosen it. Always work with it, not against it. Make it your friend and ally, not your enemy. Once the situation has been accepted, if it needs to be changed and you have the power to do so, then change it, but first accept it. Now, it turns out, remember we're talking about cognitive reappraisal, that people who are able to look at a situation and reappraise it tend to use the prefrontal cortex to inhibit negative stimuli associated with the amygdala. Now, one form of cognitive reappraisal is humor. And again, we were surprised that humor was such an important part of resilience for many people. Viktor Frankl, who wrote Man's Search for Meaning, a Holocaust survivor, who was quite a remarkable person, this is what he says about humor. Humor is another of the soul's weapons in the fight for self-preservation. It is well known that humor, more than anything else in the human makeup, can afford an aloofness and an ability to rise above any situation, even if for a few seconds. And I think that's because we look at the situation somewhat from a distance. We reappraise it. We reassess it. Sometimes we even laugh at it in order to gain some control over it. And the second quote is Woody Allen, I'm not afraid of death, but I would rather be somewhere else when it happens. This ability to reappraise can be very important when dealing with failure. This is a great quote. I love this. Thomas Edison. If I find 10,000 ways something won't work, I haven't failed. I am not discouraged because every wrong attempt discarded is another step forward. And again, James Stockdale, the senior commanding officer at the Hanoi Hilton, to handle tragedy may be the mark of an educated man, for one of the principal goals of education is to prepare man for failure. Now, it's actually possible to grow as a result of trauma. So there's a term called post-traumatic growth. And so sometimes when people have been through traumatic situations, along with the tragedy and the horror and the painful symptoms, there might also be a greater appreciation of life, perhaps enhanced wisdom and maturity, maybe newfound meaning and purpose, or greater compassion, or closer ties with family, maybe some improved coping skills. We found this in the next slide with prisoners of war who had been brutally tortured, sometimes 7 years in Vietnam, and most of them, they didn't want to go through this again, no way. But most of them, years later, felt that they had a greater appreciation of life because of their experience, and that they had grown in strength in some ways, even though they had suffered dramatically, and so forth. Training. We can all become more resilient. Anyone can become more resilient. It's not easy. It's easier for some individuals because they have more resources available to them. So it can be harder for some people, but there's always an opportunity. And this next slide, stress inoculation, saying that too little stress and you really don't grow. Too much stress and you can weaken or damage. And as we said before, optimal stress is out of your comfort zone, but not overwhelmed. And I think really great coaches and parents and therapists and so forth understand with their mentee or their child, they have a pretty good understanding of where that outside of comfort zone is. And so they can help their child or mentee grow, but not push them or encourage them to get into the zone where it's actually unmanageable. And with next slide, and with resilience, we can talk about stress management, where the goal is to reduce stress, which is very good. For example, with soldiers, decreasing the length of their deployment to Iraq or Afghanistan, that's important. That's decreasing the amount of stress. Or learning relaxation training and so forth, meditation, that's decreasing the amount of stress. But you can also engage in, as the next slide says, resilience training, where I'm not just reducing stress, I'm trying to learn how to grow from stress. Easier said than done, but there's a term called passive toughening, if you will, where, as I said, we're all getting exposed to stresses during our life. Is there some way that I can use this most current stressor to become stronger? Maybe, maybe not. But is there some way, something I can learn from this? And that's using stressors that are already there. And then there's something called active stress toughening, where I intentionally go and expose myself to progressively increasing levels of stress that I can handle. And that, like I said, you know what, I'm gonna run a marathon, or not necessarily a marathon, but I'm going to run a 5K because I think it'll be good for me physically and I think it'll be good for me emotionally in terms of how I feel about myself, resilience, and so forth. And I'm going to intentionally do that, but I'm going to train in progressively increased amounts. So that'd be active toughening. And people talk about resilient attitudes. What's a resilient attitude? Well, that stress, at least at times, may be an opportunity for growth. Maybe. That's not to say that we're welcoming stress, believe me. And a resilient attitude might be the challenges, I've got to do the best I can to try to meet this challenge. And as I said, life is not fair. Many people have much greater challenges than others. So it's easier to talk about for some people. And we also know that if we're going to achieve something, we have to work very hard at it. And we have to do our best to try to persevere. Now, the nice thing that neuroscientists have learned about in the last decade or two decades is that the brain is much more plastic than we used to think. And experience rewires the brain. In other words, the more I practice a particular skill, the more space in the brain and the more wiring the brain devotes to supporting that new skill. I am changing my brain as I practice a particular skill so it becomes easier and easier to accomplish that skill. And the next slides are, I can train physically, I can train in meditation. The more I do it, the better I get. The next slide is all the remarkable benefits of exercise. It even helps to repair parts of the brain that can become damaged. And part of resilience is learning to recover. We often talk about this training to be stress inoculated, but you have to know how to recover. And that means that walking or jogging or yoga or stretching or meditating or praying or playing non-competitive sports or deep breathing or getting plenty of sleep, nutrition, listening to music, all sorts of possible ways to recover from stress. And here's a quote on meditation, which I believe in. Learning to meditate, observe the mind and body, and direct attention to the present moment allows us to face whatever comes to us calmly and courageously, knowing we have the flexibility to weather any storm gracefully. I have to say that that's a lifetime of work, because I try this, and it helps, but I must say, I can't face all the stresses and traumas and so forth as calmly and courageously as I'd like to, believe me. But I do think it helps. So the next slides summarize. There's learning to face fears, cultivating positive emotions, actively coping with stress, not passive, active, solidifying moral compass, practicing religion and spirituality, if that works for you, seeking and attracting social support, going out there and finding social support, trying to be as flexible cognitively as possible in your thoughts and your explanations, training and recovering, finding and imitating role models. I didn't talk about this, but find people in your life who you think, you know, that person really handles stress well, and study that person. You can actually ask them, how do you do it? People like to be asked things like this. And you might notice that a resilient role model, you know, every time they face stress, they always reach out to their friends and they attract social support. Well, now you have a principle. And then extracting purpose and meaning from your life. And I'll end with meaning and purpose. And here are a few quotes. Men are strong as long as they stand for an idea. He who has a why can endure almost any how. And of course, the great Nelson Mandela was able to tolerate 30 years of imprisonment with grace and dignity because his imprisonment stood for equality for all. It had meaning. And this is a beautiful quote, I believe, from Martin Seligman. People who are impoverished, depressed, or suicidal care deeply about much more than just the relief of their suffering. They care sometimes desperately about virtue, about purpose, about integrity, and about meaning. The best therapists do not merely heal damage. They help people identify and build their strengths and their virtues. And this search for meaning that applies to every single one of us is an active process. It's a searching. And for meaning is different for each person. And it is, in some ways, our responsibility to do our best to search for what will be meaningful for us. This is a quote from Elizabeth Lucas, who is a wonderful therapist. The forces of fate that bear down on man and threaten to break him also have the power to ennoble him. The meaning of fate lies in our response to it. And this, I'm just about to end. I'm sure you're getting tired of listening to me talk. But there's even something called a survivor mission, where sometimes people can take their tragedy, and this is very tough, but some people are able to do it, and compensate for their tragedy and make it a gift for others. This slide is a gentleman, a remarkable gentleman, who's become a friend of ours, Jerry White. As a sophomore in college, he was hiking in the Golan Heights in Israel, stepped on a landmine, lost his leg, became depressed, almost died, but eventually, after years of struggling and reappraising and so forth, he eventually helped to form the International Landmine Survivors Network, which won the Nobel Peace Prize. And in the next slide, he's sitting with Princess Diana, who also wanted to rid the world of landmines. And in the next slide, he's sitting with two World War II survivors who lost their limbs in the war. And next slide is that of Christopher Reeves, who, as you know, was a very good actor. We respected him as an actor. But I think at least many of us respected him even more, perhaps, or gained even renewed respect by the way he dealt with his just awful tragedy. And so the last slide is just to let you know that you already know this, that resilience is really everywhere. And in fact, we are all more resilient than we really know. We all have strengths inside that we just don't even know about, or we forget to tap into, or we don't know quite how to do that. But we are, all of us, stronger than we think. In any case, thank you very much, and if there are any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Thank you so much. That was a really wonderful talk, and we have a, you know, as you and I have talked about, we have a very wide audience for these series. We have consumers, family members, clinicians, researchers, educators, and I think that your talk really had something to offer for everyone. So again, thank you so much for generously donating your time.
Thank you.
We just have one question, and just enough time to answer it. The question is whether of the 10 lessons that you talked about and that summarize your work over the years, if you could just say something about any changes of how you would advise applying these in the case of people with BPD, or if they would be generally true regardless. Any kind of changes or caveats relevant to individuals with BPD is the question.
No, I think that's a very good question. If you think about a number of these factors, let me step back. I personally think that a number of these factors are slightly more doable than others, without a tremendous amount of training. One of them is exercise. I can't tell you how powerful exercise can be, both psychologically and physically. People who get in pretty good physical shape tend to be less depressed, tend to be less anxious. They deal with stress better. And so that's one area that most people, you know, after checking with a physician and so forth, that most people can do right away. Another that I think is really powerful and very much for borderline personality, for all of us, is the quality of your social network. Now, I know that sometimes we feel we've alienated people, we feel we've burned bridges, and so forth. We feel that people are frustrated with us, but in fact, there tend to be people in our network who still love us, who still care about us. And I would say one of the best and most important things that anyone can do, and people with borderline PPD as well, is to really pay close attention to that network of yours. What I do with every person who comes in to see us nowadays, I didn't do this before, is I have the person sit down and draw a diagram of their social network. Who's in your network? Who do you communicate with every day, or at least once a week, or at least once a month, or at least once a year? Who are the people in your world that you actually interact with? How often do you interact with them? What is the quality of that relationship, in your opinion? Are there people you can really trust and count on? And equally important, who are the people that you will go to their aid? Who are the people in the network who you feel and you enjoy helping? So I do know that emotional turmoil and so forth, we feel that we burn bridges and so forth, but we can always form relationships and support groups and family, and even if we don't have family, forming these networks, learning how to form networks, both in therapy, in skill groups and so forth, we can all learn to be better at forming relationships and at learning how to really care for to really understand what other people are feeling and to attend to what they need as well as what we need. So those are two mm-hmm. exercise and actually social network to me is really, really important.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you. We actually had one more question just come in. Does working through past trauma build resilience?
That's a very good question. It can, in that by working through, and that's a very complicated question, but it certainly can help. It can help a lot, actually, depending on the person. As one of the things about working through is that I come to understand this trauma in a new way, that it has a different meaning for me. At least that's how I think of working through. And I learn to not exactly accept it, but to incorporate it in some way in my life. It's there anyway, and find ways to move on. By working through traumas in general, they don't hold you back as much. At least that's what most therapists would say. But yes, I think under working cognitive processing therapies, DBT, all sorts of different therapies can be very helpful and helping you, the individual, deal with future stresses. Yes, absolutely. The question is yes. The answer is yes.
Wonderful. Well, thank you again for this great talk and donating your time, and this will be archived on the website. And then just a reminder to folks calling in, next week on August 24th, we will have our next session will be on August 24th, with Dr. Alex Chapman with the title Understanding Emotional Dysregulation in BPD. All right, signing off. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you.